Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. I am Nancy Arnold, the interim minister with this congregation. Thank you all for being here this morning. Whether you're here for the first time, or you're a longtime member, or just returning, we welcome you and invite everyone to stay for conversation and refreshments after the service. In this shared ministry, I lead services two or three times a month, with other services being led by worship associates or guest speakers. We are very fortunate to have Nancy Remkes with us this morning. Thank you for once again sharing your musical gifts with us, Nancy. And I want to take this opportunity to acknowledge the enormous effort that Nancy put into producing the recent series of Musician Share concerts. Thank you for working with Sue and Margie. You put together a fabulous lineup of musicians and raised a lot of money for some of the charities of their choice, and we're still getting thank you notes, so you'll still be getting copies of thank you notes. And we're grateful to have Kent Martin today as worship associate. We prepare ourselves for worship. Please silence all electronic devices until the service has ended.
Swimming in the stream together, some in doubt.
In the holy quiet of this hour, this is sacred time that cannot be taken from us. We sit together, a company of believers in life. If we are still, we can hear a great communal breathing. We sit here to receive the blessings of life, the memories that drift across our minds, the hopes harbored in these few moments, the dreams that we dare to conjure in the magic of this time. May we take the time, here and now, to celebrate moments like these. May we savor this intermission from the cares of our lives. May we be renewed for the living of these days and all the days to come. All this we seek in the holy quiet of this hour. I invite you to read from your order of service as we light our chalice this morning. We gather this hour as people of the faith,
with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together.
And I invite you to rise in body or in spirit to join in singing hymn number 1008 in the teal hymnal, When Our Heart is in a Holy Place. This morning is from Exploring Our Unitarian Universalist Principles and Sources Through Wisdom Tales by Gail Forsyth Bale. It's about a boy who loved the outdoors and he wanted to explore everything he saw. The boy's name was Charles Darwin. From the time he was a little boy, Charles Darwin was an explorer. He loved to roam the fields and hills near his home in Shrewsbury, England. He was fascinated by the movements of small animals and insects, and he knew each wildflower by name. He was curious about everything he saw and heard and touched. He wondered at the lives of ants and butterflies. He examined and collected rocks, delighted in the grasses, trees, leaves, and flowers that provided homes for his very favorite creature, the beetle. Curiosity about the world and the place of humans in it was a gift given to Charles by both his grandfathers. They were Unitarians, and they believed that human beings did not yet know all the answers to life's great questions. The clues were to be found in observing the world around them. When Charles was 8, his mother died. This is a picture. Not long after, his father decided to send Charles away to school, where he might learn the things that young gentlemen in his day were expected to know: Greek, Latin, ancient history. I'm sure you can tell how excited he was about this. Charles was much more interested in the workings of an anthill, or the mysteries found in a rock pile, than he was in what was being taught at school. At every opportunity, he took long walks outdoors, watching, listening, collecting. He delighted in figuring out how creatures behaved and how the natural world worked. This wasn't at all what his father had in mind. He was worried. What would young Charles do when he grew up? What kind of man would he be? So when Charles was 15, his father sent him to medical school to become a doctor like his father and grandfather. But Charles wasn't interested in medicine. Instead, he found people who would teach him all about different kinds of plants. And he began to draw these plants in great detail, labeling all the parts, learning to tell one variety from another. 2 years later, Charles left medical school. It was clear that he didn't want to be a doctor. His father was furious, and he thought that the endless hours Charles spent outdoors were a waste of time. Determined that Charles would make something of himself, his father sent him to Cambridge University to become a minister. Charles wasn't unhappy with that decision. In those days, ministers often did science experiments and observations in their spare time. Why they had spare time, I have no idea. Charles planned to find a small church in the countryside and spend most of his time observing and drawing plants, animals, rocks, and insects. He was still very interested in collecting beetles. Here's some of the drawings that he made of beetles. Could one of the kids help me by holding this up, maybe? That he drew pictures of. He tore a piece of bark off a tree one day, and he saw two rare kinds of beetles. He had one in each hand when he saw a third that he wanted to add to his collection. So he quickly popped one beetle in his mouth in order to grab the third one. Very bad results. The beetle squirted something really nasty tasting in his mouth, and he was forced to spit it out. At Cambridge, Charles discovered what his life's work would be, and he began to call himself a naturalist. Charles went on a journey around the world for 5 years. And as he traveled, he filled notebooks with drawings like these, and he made lots of notes. He stayed open to the curiosities of the natural world as they presented themselves: frogs, salamanders, armadillos, insects, and lots of fossils. He understood how plants and animals work when he returned to England 5 years later. They evolved from one another over the course of many thousands and millions of years. This is the picture of him when he returned from his voyage. One of the other kids want to hold this up? Would you hold that up? So 22 years later, Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species. Scientists, preachers, and teachers took notice, and so did the press. The boy collector with the gift of wonder, a spirit of adventure and openness to new ideas, had become the scientist. His theory responded to the mysteries of mysteries. And this is the picture of him more or less the time that he came up with The Origin of the Species, 1854, in that range. It's interesting to watch his hairline receding in these pictures. Today, people still take notice and they debate what Charles Darwin had to say. And this is the picture probably most of us are more familiar with. But he wasn't born looking like this. He evolved into this. So, excellent, thank you. So, I wanted you to hear about that because today we're talking about atheism and people who have a more rationalistic view of the world and religion. And I thought the children would like to hear that before they head to their classes. So let us sing the children out for their classes. I thank you for joining us and helping with all these illustrations.
So now in peace, may the spirit of love surround you everywhere.
I think they're going to have a lot more fun than we might, but we can hear about it afterwards. We're not designed to be in this life alone. We come here out of a desire to feel connected to something or to someone. That's the reason for congregations such as this. We need one another, and we need to be known to each other. So when we share our concerns, our joys, and our hopes each week, our burdens become lighter and the goodness of our lives becomes a shared blessing. Let us bring into this circle of caring those who are unable to be with us today, those who are present, and those who are with us only in memory. Would you light one last candle for the joys, hopes, and concerns that go unexpressed here this morning? You can also come forward during the offertory music and light a candle in silence. We hold in the heart of this community those whose candles speak for them, those who are ill or grieving, those whose pain is too great to name, and a world community so in need of healing, especially those people who are suffering or displaced by the catastrophic climate conditions that are occurring in various parts of the world. In the stillness of a shared silence, let us hold them and each other gently in the strength and comfort of this religious community.
Thank you.
invite you to read responsively with me, reading number 515 in the Gray Hymnal. We lift up our hearts in thanks. For the sun and the dawn, which we did not create.
For the moon and the evening, which we did not make.
For food which we plant but cannot grow.
For friends and loved ones we have not earned.
For this gathered company, which welcomes us as we are from wherever we have come.
For all our free churches that keep us human and encourage us in our quest for beauty, truth, and love.
For all things which come to us as gifts of being from sources beyond ourselves.
Gives us life and love and friendship. We lift up our hearts and thanks this day.
Let us prepare ourselves for a time of meditation and silence by singing hymn number 123, Spirit of Life, in the Gray Hymnal. Quiet ourselves in a spirit of reflection with these words by Richard Gilbert. Here in this house of worship, we assemble not to solve the mysteries of existence, but to confront them, not to find answers to all our questions, but to realize the profoundest questions have no answers, not to put an end to our doubts, but to learn to live with them. Let us be in silence together. I look into the world in which the sun is shining, in which the stars are sparkling, in which the stones repose, where living plants are growing, where sentient beasts are living, where human souls on earth give dwelling to the spirit. I look into the soul that lives within my being, where the world weaves in sunlight and in soul light. The mid-20th century was a time of great turmoil in the public sphere. The post-World War II decade became known as the McCarthy era, in which suspected communists, who are atheists, were exposed and often charged with treason. The Red Scare unified citizens and politicians to advocate for the prominent alignment of God with patriotism. Laws were changed, public prayer was promoted, and America became synonymous with being God's chosen people. If the 50s were a backlash to what was framed by some as the totalitarian trends of the New Deal, the next decade erupted in total rebellion against everything held sacred by the greatest generation. There was great furor over the God is Dead movement. Theologians debated, critiqued, and dismantled the historical notions of God. Faith in a supernatural power was dismissed as naive. But somehow, God survived the 60s and the 70s, at least in the minds of many people. And like the phoenix, God rose renewed from the ashes of God's own demise. Today, God is evoked everywhere from government gatherings and sports events to houses of worship and court proceedings. God bless America. In God we trust. One nation under God. Under God the people rule. So help me God. With God all things are possible. Politicians vie with each other to get the God vote. Debates about including God in federal and state mottos and public schools, they're not really so much about God as they are about the separation of church and state. The controversy arises when God is equated with religion and therefore with church. When atheists and agnostics act to defend their right for God-free zones in public schools, they are charged with trying to replace God's sovereignty with that of the ACLU. Before the controversies end, God may choose death over life in such a climate. Thank God I'm an atheist. I want no part of the God who is so omniscient and powerful that he is responsible for our federal and state governments. He didn't even campaign for the position, although it might be a good time to start given the field of presidential candidates thus far. The problem with being an atheist is that it's often equated with being anti-religious. Just because atheists deny the existence of God doesn't mean they're not religious. As Unitarian Universalists, we know that to be true. Our congregations are made up of atheists, humanists, deists, theists, Christians, pagans, and God knows what else. We respect the differences among us, and we accept our many beliefs as part of the beauty of our free religion. For atheists, it may be in the congregation itself that faith is manifested. Believers in God just can't fathom how people who are atheists can possibly be good. You've probably all heard it said that atheists are just Christians who don't realize it yet. This condescending view validates the notion that people cannot be good without the oversight of a judging God. By its very definition, atheism is a negation of the existence of God. But to define atheism solely in reference to God is to limit its potential. In his book, The Faith of the Atheist, Arthur Gibson asserts that every human being must be motivated by some sort of faith. This does not mean that the atheist is really a believer in the traditionally accepted sense of that word. The fact that Western culture has evolved in a predominantly theistic context means that faith has taken exclusively religious overtones. Gibson acknowledges that we are surrounded by what he calls mysteries and imponderables. He distinguishes between those who refer all mysteries to a supreme being and those who do not take refuge in theistic solutions. Atheists are not content to explain all mysteries through God. And unless the atheist is a doctrinaire rationalist, one is perfectly willing to admit that there are enigmas. It's just that atheists grapple much more intensely with life's mysteries and can offer important insights on the nature of the universe. Atheism is not merely the absence of God. It isn't as if there's something missing from their lives. Being an atheist simply allows for the presence of faith in something other than a supernatural being. As one atheist puts it, there are as many kinds of unbelievers as there are, to borrow a common atheist analogy, homosexuals. You meet retired doctors, feminist advocates, for the legalization of hemp, college activists, and truck drivers. It's the house joke. Getting atheists together is like herding cats. Most overt atheists, however, share one striking characteristic. They reject God with the same passion and intensity that others use to embrace him. Where atheists may fall short is in presuming that God is what believers make him out to be. Just as there are many variations of atheism, there are at least as many ways of perceiving God. When I'm asked to describe what God is, I usually respond by saying that I can't. How can one describe the unknowable? The only people who seem to know what God is for sure are religious fundamentalists and atheists. Ironically, they share the same image of God, and neither leaves room for different perspectives about God. Unitarian Universalists have wrestled with the language of God, the gender of God, the presence or absence of God, and the truth about God. Unitarians were forerunners in rejecting the traditional God as presented in the Bible. Until about the 1800s, Unitarians clung to the Bible as the supreme revelation of God. The departure from tradition came with the advent of reason injected into Unitarian thought. Unitarian Universalism is anachronistic as a religion. How can you be a church when you do not share the same beliefs is a question that I am frequently asked by non-UUs. This gives me an opportunity to explain something about our liberal religious tradition. One might also ask the question, how can an atheist be religious and participate in such a congregation? The answers are fairly simple. To be religious is to be connected to something, to someone, or something beyond ourselves. To be religious is to create a bond between ourselves and other people or things. For some, that might be God or Goddess, Jesus or Buddha, or some personal philosophy. For others of us, that bond exists between us and the other members of the congregation. There is no great mystery here, because we continue to question and to reason our way through the mysteries of life, we are free to accept one another where we are. We may not always understand one another's faith stance, but we can be encouraging and accepting of it in the context of this congregation. Our Unitarian forebears paved the way for us to become a rather eclectic congregation, such as we see here today. With the displacement of the Bible in favor of reason, Unitarians began the difficult task of learning to broaden and accept different definitions of the religious life. Humanism had its roots with Unitarian ministers and laypeople. While all atheists are not necessarily humanists, it might be safe to say that most humanists are atheists. Humanists are as varied as atheists and Unitarian Universalists. But there is some common ground among humanists that might just as easily apply to atheists. Both place an emphasis on the value of sincerity and a corresponding scorn of hypocrisy. They all stress the importance of living the good life here and now, rather than worrying about what is to come afterward. Great emphasis is placed on the self-development by the individual and taking social responsibility in a corporate way. Inspiration is found in contemplating the upward sweep of evolution and the noble lives of the great heroes of human progress. The point upon which they are unanimous and most insistent is the rejection of the belief in the supernatural. In 1930, 3 years prior to the adoption of the Humanist Manifesto, Charles Francis Potter observed that the gap between humanism and other religions is so great, and very frequently humanists are charged with being atheists. Atheist is simply a convenient derogatory epithet applied by the orthodox to the unorthodox. The person using it assumes that his God is the only true God. Potter suggests that the difference between humanists and atheists is that the latter deny the existence of God, and the former say simply that they just don't know. If humanists were to make a creed, he said, the first article would be, I believe in man. Today we would say, I believe in humanity. The humanist-theist controversy in Unitarianism spanned the period from World War I through the end of World War II. That may surprise some of you sitting here who think we're in the midst of it now. Truly not in most places. Religious humanist and Unitarian Universalist Mason Olds recalls that the conclusion reached at the end of that controversy was that one could be either a humanist or a theist and still be a member of a Unitarian church. Like atheism, humanism cannot be defined only by what it is not. The second Humanist Manifesto in 1973 traced the roots of contemporary humanism to ancient China, classical Greece and Rome, through the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, to the scientific revolution of the modern world. But views that merely reject theism are not equivalent to humanism. They lack commitment to the positive belief in the possibilities of human progress and to the values that are central to it. Dr. Olds speaks particularly about religious humanists, which are different from secular humanists. Religious humanists, he says, believe in reality as a unified whole. They believe that what is real is the natural world. The religious humanist believes that the God of Judaism and Christianity, as well as the Greek Olympian gods, were created by humans. Religious humanists do not view human beings as depraved sinners, nor as angels. They view humans as part of the natural world. Being an atheist does not keep one from being religious or faithful. Atheism is not a lack of something. In fact, being an atheist is life-affirming. It's very freeing to have faith in the here and now. It can be liberating not to divert precious energy towards some supreme being, which, by some accounts, doesn't give a damn. One is not limited by being an atheist. Rather, the possibilities for belief are limitless. Now, I do not doubt that each of you sitting here this morning is a religious person, even though you might not describe yourself that way. I have no idea what your personal beliefs are, but the fact that you're here on a beautiful day like this tells me that you want a connection to something or someone beyond yourself. Thinking our way through to a religious construct for our lives is a hallmark of our liberal religious tradition. As our Unitarian forebears demonstrated, we continue to evolve and to grow and to embrace the unknown as religious people. How we conceive of that unknown is what helps to keep us honest with each other. One of the most lovable curmudgeons in the Akron congregation was a self-avowed atheist humanist. He was also a physicist. He was not shy about letting his opinions be known to anyone who would listen. In one of the many letters he wrote to the local newspaper, Charlie Wilson addressed the unfinished nature of our lives as religious people. The year was 2000, and he was responding to the controversy about teaching creationism as science in the public schools. Charlie wrote, "One of the joys of scientific study is to discover things today that we didn't know yesterday. One might truly say that all good science is still only an incomplete theory. Accordingly, it is clearly true that evolution is an incomplete theory, but a challenging, fascinating, and most valuable theory about which more and more is being learned each year. Turn now to the concept of God," he writes. "According to the New York Times Almanac, of the 6 billion people on Earth, about a third are termed Christian, and about 1 in 5 are atheist or non-religious. Also, about 1 in 5 are Muslim, who, like Christians, believe in one God. But it is not at all clear that the Muslim God is the same as the Christian God. About 1 in 8 people are Hindu, who believe in several gods. Is there really A, no God, B, one God, C, several gods? Who is right? And how do we go about judging who is right? In the absence of some fair and impartial means of deciding this fundamental question, he says, are we therefore justified in saying the God concept is, at present, still only an incomplete theory? I think Charlie and Len Davenport would have found common ground on which to discuss their respective worldviews. Len is a former active member at UUCSF. In recalling the days at Watermill, Len writes, what both Gail and I found broadening and valuable was the variety of speakers. We learned things almost every time. The congregation led rituals of lighting the candles, reading to children, the singing of hymns, somewhat stripped of religious words, moments of quietude, sharing of joys and sorrows, and the focus on social issues and humanist values and actions. I find Len's description of his spiritual experience to be very akin to my own, and I suspect it might be to many of you here. He says, overwhelming awe to me is a spiritual experience. For truly religious people who seem to have a special presence, I think religion is the attempt to try and explain awe. For me, every scientific discovery opens a window into the workings, if not the origin, of awesome things. Every New York Times short science doc provides a wow moment. Atheists help keep us honest. Who else will dare to ask the tough questions and scrutinize the imponderables and mysteries of life with such discernment? So I want to leave you with another imponderable mystery about which one UU minister wonders. Bob Kaufman writes, I can't prove it, but I have a most positive idea. There is no God. I have thought things through to the beginning, and I am certain. If there were a God before there was a beginning, then where did God come from? I am certain you can't answer that. I'm also certain of one other thing. This bothers me even more. I have thought things through to the beginning, and I don't know. Where does an idea come from? So be it. Let us join in singing our closing hymn, number 128, For All That Is Our Life. It's in the gray hymnal.
You.
you to join hands as we extinguish our chalice and read the benediction. We extinguish this flame,
but not the light of truth, the warmth of community,
or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. I avow my faith in a benign cosmic creativity, a creative impulse that pervades the universe, manifest on earth as nature, over time as history, and in humanity as love. I avow my faith in the free and disciplined search for truth in religious community, in the authority of truth known or to be known, in the inherent worth of each human being, the dignity of every earth citizen, in the power of people of goodwill and sacrificial spirit who seek to transcend their finitude. I avow my faith to work to create the beloved community of earth. Amen and amen, and blessed be.